Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. This is episode 229. I'm joined today by Chris Morgan and Justin Troop.
Back in gray.
What's up, folks?
We are the Bella Lost Souls podcast. We're coming up on the show's 5-year anniversary.
Dun, dun, dun.
We're not toddlers anymore.
I don't know what we're going to do special for it. We might do some new t-shirts. I haven't quite decided yet. I did just get, like, if you look at our Facebook logo, you'll see a new logo there, which is the rocks glass with some headphones around it, you know, like every other podcast has. But it's cool because it's us.
I mean, and you've got to admit that those headphones are huge. So that means we're a big deal.
That's right. And I also have another stylized piece of art that's in a similar vein, but a little much more casual. And anyway, it might look good on a shirt. We might do that. That's one way that when we do put those up, that people can really support the show. And that's one of the ways that, you know, you can buy something to support the show, because all that goes directly back into funding the show and everything else. But how you can support the show for absolutely free is just wherever you listen to us, make sure you give us a like, a thumbs up, a share, or whatever, a 5-star rating. If there's wherever you're listening to us has that, please give us that 5 stars. On this show, we're going to talk about something. I actually got a question on one of the videos that I did for YouTube. One of the questions we had that I did a short video about was, how do I make a Black Templar's army list? And this was a long time ago, and I don't know if it's exactly relevant now that we've had all the codexes and stuff come out. And they asked me how I would revise it, and then something kind of stuck out to me. And in the middle of this show, I've got a really long segment that I do with Reese Robbins from Frontline Gaming, and one of the tournament organizers from LVO, SoCal Open, and the Bay Area Open, plus many, many more. ITC Architect. We have a really nice long segment. And then when we come back, I'm going to have a little bit of a hobby rant. Just something that's been really bothering me for several days. I'm going to talk about it.
Get it off your chest, brother.
Yeah. Don't hate me for being the most excited about the rant.
But, I'll try to keep it clean, but there might be some beeps in this show. I'll say that. So on the topic that I want to talk about first, and this is, we've been talking about like how to beat things and how to shake up what you take. If you don't feel like taking the grizzly bear list, you know, the demons or the Yanari or whatever, then how do you make sure that you can compete in that area? And this piggybacked off the Black Templar question that I got on YouTube pretty easily, because I started to think about, what would I really do? And I'd probably take right now less Assault Centurions, but still having Black Templars in my list is not bad because of a stratagem that I think that we all kind of just glossed over the first time it came out, and that is the Abhor the Witch Black Templar stratagem. This is a one command point thing that use this stratagem: when an enemy psyker manifests a psyche power within 24 inches of a friendly Black Templar's unit, roll a d6. On a 4+, that psyche power is resisted by the sheer willpower of your unit, and its effects are negated.
That's a huge, huge range for a denial power.
Well, it's 24 inches from any unit, so it's not dependent upon a librarian or some single model. It's a unit. So a unit of scouts spaced out, in full max unit coherency, has a really big bubble of deny power.
Yeah, that's really strong. And then, you're mentioning some of those, the Inari and demons and such. Those are very psychic heavy lists. And being able to shut them down is really a wrench in their plans.
Well, you're obviously being able to do it once. You're not going to shut a lot down, but they're one of those armies that we're talking about, like the demons and the Unari and stuff. They can compete in every phase. They can compete in the movement phase. They can compete in the psyche phase, the shooting phase, the assault phase. If they slant their way, their builds towards that, they can really do something in every single phase. And sometimes it's predicated just on one single power. And I want to talk about the runes of battle that the warlocks can get. They have a power in there called Quicken, way better than our Quickening on the Blood Angel side. But
oh, shots fired.
All right.
Shots fired.
Well, yeah, I actually pulled, I had Quickening in my army recently. And they're like, oh, doesn't it let you do this? I'm like, no, it doesn't. It lets me do this other thing. But anyway,
much less exciting.
Well, you can't cast it on another unit. Like I can't quickening my death company. You know, that would be really nice.
Or like I don't know, Sanguinary Guard. That would be even nicer.
Yeah. So the quicken restrain, that's the reverse of it, has a warp charge value of 7. If manifested, choose one of the following. Quicken is choose a friendly Asurani infantry or biker unit within 18 inches of the Psyker. That unit can immediately move as if it were the movement phase. You cannot use Quicken on a single unit more than once per psychic phase. Restrain is it's an attack power. You have the movement of an enemy. I've never seen anyone cast Restrain. I've only seen them cast Quicken. And in something like this, they'll use the warp tunnel to bring in some shining spears, quicken them, they get another move, and then they're in your grill and assaulting, you know, that type of stuff.
Yep. Well, and I think the biggest thing to emphasize when we're talking about using this stratagem is knowing when to pop it.
Yeah, which power is going to get you, right? Which power? And this is one of the powers that's really going to get you. And I want to bring up the fact that this has a warp charge value of 7, meaning it needs a 7 or greater to cast, which means that even if you were denying, you've got 50-50 or worse of denying this power if they successfully cast it. The odds are not in your favor to deny this psyche power. The other side of that is warp time on the demon stuff. You know, people will bring in their, they'll get the Dark Hereticus discipline to get the warp time. They'll cast it on Magnus or Mortarion or whatever. And then it's all she wrote. You know, then it's a slugfest from the beginning and you're not able to set your defenses. You're not going to be able to set the momentum of the game. And so these things that increase the movement on some really great units are like priority number one to want to block.
Yeah, especially when you're not really prepared for something like this. Like, we live in a land of turn one charges now, right? They're a thing. But it's still, you don't prepare for certain things. And if you're not preparing for them, you're doing something wrong in regards to these spells like warp time and quickening or quicken. These are the things that are game-breaking. Like, or not game breaking.
They're not game breaking, but they are definitely
strategy
winning. They're winning maneuvers. Yeah. Like you can break the back of your opponent on turn one or whenever you were able to set up these kind of real overhand right type moves things. Warp time has a warp charge value of 6 and a much shorter range. So you know, a minimum cast warp time, I guess you are able to 50-50 get this off. But where I'm going with that line of thinking is when someone casts this power, like say it's, you know, a Magnus or something with a +2 to cast, then you're looking at a big number to have to just block it. And this Abhor the Witch for one command point will allow you to get a 50-50 shot at blocking one of these backbreaking powers that you could then also use a command point for to reroll if you needed to.
Now, I think it's very important to point out, too, that a lot of times the powers that you're trying to stop aren't the powers that are going to be dealing out a massive amount of damage. It's often going to be about denying mobility or utility on a unit or model. You know, just, again, coming back to picking the one that you want to deny, so much of this game is about, like with the Shining Spears, getting up in your face to guarantee that charge is going to get off, or, you know, stopping the warp time from doubling the movement of a key model or set of models. Like, those things are going to be the things I think that this is going to have the highest return on, as opposed to stopping a smite.
Right. So one of the things that, like, how Shining Spears kind of excel at beating a guard army potentially is to jump over the screen and then lock up a lot of the tanks. And so they lose a round of fire while they're all falling back from the Shining Spears if they weren't destroyed, you know, one or two weren't destroyed in the charge. So that move, that additional move power is critical. And you start to think of like, what are my actual odds? If I've got a Primaris Psyker, what are my actual odds of getting my one deny roll to successfully stop a cast quicken? And that's not provided that I'm even in range to cast, because that quicken power has an 18-inch range that are cast on something else, and you have to cast
further away.
Yeah, then you have to deny, within range of the Psyker casting it. So how do you get your Primaris Psyker up there in a way to effectively even get a shot at denying it? Let me tell you, you don't. You don't really get to do that. I mean, yeah. Unless a lot of other things are going right your way already.
You really have to think about, like, why are we stopping this power? You know, you've explained how the jetpacks can jump over you, tie up the tanks, things like that. I relate these powers similar to the movie Troy, when at the very beginning of the movie where Achilles runs up, casts warp time, dodges a little bit, and then swords that dude in the neck. Like, that's what this power does. So you have to understand that it's setting up the denial and stuff like this is something that you have to plan for a little bit more. And that's kind of what you're alluding to, Paul, with the placement of what you're going to do. A Primaris Psyker is not the kind of guy that you're just going to throw out in there in the front. But the power behind the stratagem is it doesn't matter who's out there. Somebody's out there.
Your chapter master with a thunder hammer and storm shield, or some dude that just teleported in Terminator armor. It could be any Black Templar unit, and anything with the Black Templar chapter tactic unit, and it's within any range of the unit. So I guess any member in the unit.
Yeah, and that's huge, because what it's doing is it's allowing you to still keep your battle plans together. You know, you're still going to have dudes that scattered around with your scouts for objectives, things like that. This is increasing your odds of being able to manipulate these denials without actually have to sacrifice your psychers or you know, whoever you're using as a denial person, if you're taking Tigerius, anything like that. So this is innately strong because everybody gets it.
Every Black Templar in a unit. So again, even if you have one guy, you got a 10-man unit of scouts with camo cloaks, and they're not able to kill all them, you know, get them all out. That last scout guy can then use this stratagem, which, you know, it's easy to look over this thing, because who wants to spend a command point for a 50-50 shot of doing something or whatever? But you kind of have to look at it in context of winning or losing the game. And if you could really pin it down to you having a coin flip to win or lose the game, but it's not even a coin flip, because again, you can re-roll the die. I think you go for it. And I think it's something that some generals out there might want to plan on having, you know. And this all came about, I was thinking, like, man, wouldn't it be awesome if I could have like Catechins and Flesh Hounds in the same army? That sounds like a little bit of a stretch, right?
That's some serious heresy right there, Paul Martin. Let me just this is where freaking Space Wolves and Dark Angels came about in 7th edition. I'm going to have to counsel you against pursuing this line of thought for the sake of the game.
Well, then, like, obviously, we'll take Heretics, but Heretics aren't as good as Catechins. I mean, obviously. I mean,
naturally, yes.
But wouldn't it be awesome to have some Flesh Hounds in that unit? Like, oh, what could I actually have is forward deniers, forward psychic power. Because that's what I wanted the Flesh Hounds. That was what I wanted a unit that could do, was to be up there as in their face, really, really deep in the enemy's deployment zone, effectively denying psychic powers. And then got the question on YouTube. And then it was just like, oh, this is something that might actually work. You know, because in a guard army, you know, it's real super easy to get that brigade. Yeah, but the guard, like, I haven't really seen guard at the several tournaments that I've been to recently. I mean, I know it's kind of a hard army to build. There's lots of models and lots of things to do in paint and stuff. But, you know, they don't stack up really well against things that can jump over their screen. And one of the main ways that things do jump over screens is with these psychic powers. And so how do you bring it in there, and how do you do it, you know, a little bit, maybe a little bit cheaper than trying to get Grey Knights or something in there, or something either less durable? A small Black Templar force gives you that one command point, which you've already got in, you know, basically in spades because of the IG brigade. You're able to do this and get this 50-50 shot pretty much every turn.
Yeah. And there's a lot of different builds that you can do to maximize with this. You know, you can go all Assault Marines if you wanted. I'm not saying this is the best option.
You were getting real crazy. I'm talking about like two units of scouts and a captain.
Right. Yeah. I'm just saying that you don't have to go with a battalion. You could go with an outrider or spearhead or something patrol. Like that.
It's anything that you can tag on this Black Templar chapter tactic to and count as Battleforge.
But I am with you. I think a few scout squads is where it's really at.
You want to go real crazy, a dreadnought.
Oof, things are getting wild over here.
I think the Dreadnoughts get it too, right? They do.
Yes, they do.
Get it, but do they get it? You know what I mean?
Look, I'm just saying that you got some points left over after you built out a really sweet guard brigade, as you know, people can listen, that you can go a little wild. A little wild.
Because is there power swords everywhere first?
Well, because you're gonna need the custodes for the autopass morale. And then you're gonna need this guy with his 4-up deny. I mean, think back in the day, how dominant were Rune Priests with a 4-up deny?
Don't
that was the thing, guys,
please. And I'm still lamenting.
Yeah, that was.
That's a Blood Angel successor chapter, Justin.
But I see what you're doing, just trying to think outside the box a little bit about what. Like, we know what's good out there. We know what's good. Like, the stuff is real efficient. And, I mean, who knows? By the time this comes out, we could even have an FAQ. You know, by the time this show comes out, then that could change up what is good. But even if some things like that happens, I believe that things like this 4-plus deny that's kind of been sleeping in this Space Marine Codex, you know, might still have a place in the game.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, there's still armies coming out, too, which I think are going to shake things up a little bit. The three armies that are specifically coming are traditionally more of a shooty armies in the past. We've seen everything turn into insane melee armies, i.e. Thousand Suns. But with Tau, with Necrons, and with what are the Dark Eldar called again?
Drukhari.
That's a weird word for me. Sorry, but I didn't want to discredit them from their true name. But with those things coming out, that's going to shake up a lot of the meta too. And so like this tactic might be null and void, you know, based off of what comes out with them. Because do you really put scouts out there knowing that there's fire warriors with 30-inch range guns that destroy stuff? Or whatever they get, we don't know what they're getting yet. But there's a lot of factors to come into play that are coming soon that could very well shake things up as well with this warp time shenanigans and things like that.
I am excited to see what's coming down the pipe, I guess. But I think it's also when we do face, we come to these challenges, you know, in the game where things are really starting to become a fixture and be the dominant and show what is the more powerful things, then that's the time when you get back in brewing and figuring out what you can do to be successful. I mean, because sometimes you know you're going to fight XYZ thing in a tournament. So how do you prepare for it with the thing that you've got already? Or what is a low barrier to entry to be able to compete that may not make you change your entire army around?
Unearth the hidden gem.
Well, that's what I want to talk about in this segment. Let's take a break. We'll come back, do that spot with Reese. It's a bit of a long segment, and then we'll come back, and it'll be me, Chris, and Justin.
Right on.
See you all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, welcome to a special segment of Forge the Narrative. I am Paul, your host. I'm joined today by Reese Robbins.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Yo, man, I got to bring you on. I know you don't need any of my help selling tickets for a couple of your tournaments. One of them is already sold out, but I still want to talk about both of them.
Yeah, well, hey, thank you so much, because they didn't always sell out. And so we're really thankful for all the help to get us to the point where they do reliably sell out. It's great to work as a team in the community.
Well, that's awesome, man. So which one's coming up first?
So we got the BAO coming up in July, and that's up in the Bay Area of California, right near San Francisco. And that's at the end of July. That one sold out in about a day.
That's 150 awesome.
Player. Yeah, no, it's every year it's been going quicker and quicker. I think next year it's going to sell out in like, you know, an hour or something. And that's 150 player 40K tournament up in the Bay. So that's the one that started it all for us. So it's got kind of a special place in our hearts. And it's a great, great event. Super fun. Can't wait to see everybody there.
Well, then there's the SoCal Open.
Yeah, the SoCal Open is in October. It's the weekend before Halloween. Those tickets will go up for sale at noon Pacific Standard Time, March 12th. That's a Monday in about 2 weeks from now. And that one, this will be the second year. Last year, if I remember, I think we had like 150 players in our first year, which is amazing. And it's in Del Mar, California, which is in northern San Diego County. It's about, it's about a mile from the beach, maybe a mile and a half from the beach. Like, Del Mar is amazing. When you think of California and you're not, you know, people who don't live in California, when they close their eyes and they think of it, that's what they think of.
They're really thinking about Del Mar there?
It's palm trees. It's, you know, sand beaches, driving down the freeway in a convertible. That's exactly what that kind of place is. It's beautiful.
It's a veritable paradise.
It I'm not trying to oversell it. Like, it really is. Just go Google Del Mar, California, and you'll be like, oh, okay, I get it.
So is this one attached to a hotel? Is this in a game store? Which, how does this work?
The SoCal Open is at the Del Mar racetrack. So it's a really famous horse racetrack, and they have a really big convention area. It's not like a convention like the Las Vegas Open. It's a little bit lower tech, I would say. There's no hotel attached, but there's a lot of hotels in the area, and most of them have shuttles that go to the racetrack.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, and the venue is gigantic. Like, we could easily expand it out to be a 500-person 40K tournament, you know, 128-person AOS tournament in time. So that's pretty exciting, and it's easy to get to, tons of parking. The hot dogs aren't the best, but they're cheap.
That's what you're looking for in a hot dog. I think that's pretty much most of people's hot dog experience, so that's fine.
Yeah, and the location is really, really cool. I think that's the biggest selling point of the event. It's for people who are traveling. You can bring your significant other, and they can go hang out at the beach, and it's just really beautiful there. So,
and this is the SoCal Open we're talking about, the one that has the tickets going on sale in March.
Exactly, exactly. For the BAO, you can go to the beach there too. The Santa Cruz, which is a really famous beach in California, isn't too far away, but it's not, you know, nearly as close as the SoCal Open is to the beach for the BAO.
I gotcha. Now, you mentioned like large number of attendees. I mean, this is a grand tournament, of course, but 150 people is still a lot of freaking people.
Yeah, the BAO is the only reason the BAO isn't like a 250, 300 person tournament is because we run out of space. The SoCal Open, I would bet, is going to get close to 300 people this year. I would not be surprised if we got up towards 300 on the nose, actually.
That sounds awesome, man. And I heard you talking about that at the BAO, you're going to experiment with maybe timing of player turns. I know you mentioned a chess clock. Is that like the is that going to be the official timekeeper? Is it how's the system going to work? And I also want to take us on a little bit different path after you answer.
Yeah, so we've been debating chess clocks since 5th edition, really, like early 6th, late 5th. And we decided to finally pull the trigger, the reason being at the LVO, like, you know, on stream, you could have seen some of the games where guys were just taking an hour to get through their first turn in a 2.5 hour round. It's just not, it doesn't work, right? Like, you're not going to finish a game. And in the high level play, we had a lot of people only getting to turns 3. And it's just not acceptable, right? Like, if we're trying to build a pro circuit, a semi-pro circuit, we're trying to make it fun to watch the game. If we want to engage people on a broader scale and say, hey, check this out. Look at this cool game. It's 6 turns and, you know, these are extremely good players, but you only get through 3 turns. It's like turning on a football game and they only play 2 quarters.
Well, not that I would ever accuse anyone of this, but it's like so easy for someone to abuse that artificial, well, I shouldn't say artificial, that hard time limit, that resource that you can't get back. Like, you can't unwind it when you're trying to run 100 other tables.
Exactly. And from I've witnessed thousands and thousands of games of 40K in a tournament setting, because we've TO'd, I can't even count how many events we've TO'd.
Yeah.
And I would say 95% of the time when a game does not go to time, or I'm sorry, when the game does not finish naturally, both players are playing slow. I've seen it over and over and over and over again. They're like, you played slow. And I'm like, no, you both played slow. I was watching you and you both took forever. And like we've talked about on our podcast many times, when you're hyper-focused on what you're doing, you go into what's called a flow state or a peak experience, and your perception of time is distorted. You know, it's like when you, if you've ever gone skydiving or done something very, an intense experience.
The blood starts pumping in your ears. You look down and you look up and it's an hour later. I mean, that's what happens.
It feels like it took a really long time, but it didn't actually take very much time at all. And that's why people's perception of it is skewed. And you hear all these accusations of slow play, but when in reality, it's usually both players are playing slowly because they're thinking so hard. And what we came, the conclusion we've come to after batting around a million ideas, debating it back and forth and back and forth, the only really equitable solution that we have seen is chess clocks, right? Like in a 2.5 hour or 3 hour game, whatever the case may be, you should get half the time. That is definitively fair.
Sure. Yep. I'm with you on that.
Yep. And so people bring up all these arguments like, oh, okay, but that's not fair for the horde player. I'm like, no, it is. Just because you showed up with a horde army doesn't mean you get more time than the other guy. That is definitively unfair.
Yeah, it's a choice you made. And you're, yeah. I'm with you. Yes, I agree.
If you can't manage your army, don't bring it. Bring something else. And we've finally come to the conclusion that, you know what, at least for the top tables, at least for the finals, this is something that has to happen because nobody wants to see a game that ended on turn three and a player won when it was pretty clear that they weren't going to win if the game went the distance and they went on a technicality. That's not fun. That's like no one enjoys that, right? The person that wins might not even enjoy that.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like, so easily attainable, if you ask me, if I can just jump in there.
Yeah, well, please do.
Well, that's it. I just believe that it should not be so easily done. Like you could game the system. One could set out to game the system and accomplish that in most of their games.
Yeah, and that's
with the way things are right now. Yeah.
To be blunt, that's I understand why. Like I said, the vast majority of times I've seen people play slow, it's not because they're trying to like angle anything because they don't know what's going to happen, right? Like it's almost always just because people are hyper focused. But if somebody were to try and leverage that, which I'm sure it does happen, probably more than it should, that's bullshit, and no one wants to see a game end that way, especially not a championship game. It's cheating the audience. It's not fun. Right?
Well, this game is ultimately it's cooperative, right? And yeah. I think that in most battles and most struggles, the loser is the one that often misinterpreted the severity of the situation and is playing by like a different set of rules than the opponent.
Yes. Yep.
And some of those rules are, now, I mean, I know I'm going way outside the box. Some of those rules are, I don't show up with an unpainted army. I don't show up with an unwizzywig army. If I feel like I'm not going to be able to complete the missions or play fast with a certain type of army, I bring something else. If I'm traveling, I want to build an army that fits on the overhead. You know what I mean? What I'm saying, these are all just rules that I've put on myself that my opponent is in no way, shape, or form obliged to follow.
I agree. And you're talking about like the meta game, right? Like talking about the competitive traveling tournament player metagame, which those all come into play, but you shouldn't add another layer of that, which is, you know, playing the clock. That's not the way the game is meant to be played. And only because we have time restraints in tournaments does this occur. And people have looked at doing it like a million ways, like an ETC that you 4 hour rounds and people still weren't finishing their games. Right. And this is true. I've talked to those guys.
I know it's true. Yeah.
Right? And then the next reaction everybody has is, well, lower the points. And I'm like, yeah, but we have mountains of data showing that people that go to the tournaments do not want to play 1,500 points. They want to play 2,000 points. And I agree, right? And you still get the fishbowl syndrome where people will take all the time that they have. So really, you need an incentive to force people to play to time. And the only thing we have found that is equitable, unbiased, and that accomplishes the goal is to use a chess clock. Because when you run out of time, 99 times out of 100, if you are only on turn three, but your opponent still has 30, 40 minutes on his clock, you're screwed. You're going to lose.
Go ahead.
So we have found that all of a sudden, games finish. And people are like, wow.
It's like magic, right?
Yeah. And you're like, yeah, because you had to. And that's what it's going to take. And I strongly believe that once we take this step, there's going to be probably a year, 6 months to a year of adjustment. And then no one will want to go back ever. It'll be like War Machine where it's like, of course you use a clock. Like that is the only way to get a fair game.
I mean, do you think this is adding an expense to an otherwise already strapped like tournament organizer?
Yes. That was one of the reasons we avoided doing it for as long as we have. We've built up a reservoir of chess clocks for War Machine. So, I mean, we already have 100 clocks or something like that. Not everybody has access to that. And so we're trying to brainstorm ideas, and I would love to get your opinion on ways to like baby step into it, right? Like maybe you only introduce chess clocks for day two for people with a winning record.
Yeah.
Right. That's an easy way to get into it. Maybe you ask your players to bring chess clocks. Maybe they use a chess clock app on their phone.
A phone app is, of course, a low bar of entry. There has to be one that's already out there in some capacity. Where I was going, though, originally when I said it was going to take us on a slightly different path, we've been talking about on my show, like, culture crafting and how that the opportunity to do it right now is higher than it's ever been because there are so many people that are wanting to come play and organize play events.
Right.
So you're going to find an audience. So you're kind of empowered to mess around and see what works in your area or try something outside the box. I mean, whether it be a chess clock or having active referees on the top five tables or something. I mean, I've been very cautious of telling people what a solution is, but more just kind of, I think, really telegraphing that if you're putting out there the risk, you're taking the risk as an organizer, there's really a tolerance out there for you to try new things because there's like lots and lots of people now wanting to come play in tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of 8th edition is that, you know, it's not perfect, but it definitely struck some of the right notes in the community. Just look at GW stock for verification of that. And you're right. This is the time to push and experiment and be bold because you do have a somewhat of a captive audience. And I agree with you 100%. It doesn't have to be a chess clock, although I believe a chess clock is the most equitable solution. You could do actively judged tables, but then you need a system in place. Like, what do you do if a player continues to play slow? Do you just, does the judge interrupt and say, you're done, your turn is over?
Some kind of hard, fast code. I'm not saying that's the easiest solution. You know, maybe you could randomly, and I'm using air quotes you can't see right now, randomly select tables to be your chess clock experiment at your tournament.
Yeah, I agree. And ultimately we have to take the Band-Aid off because if in a matched play competitive game, and I don't mean like, you know, be it unpleasant to play, just in a game where the winning or losing is the primary concern of both players, you have to do something, right? Because people are not finishing their games. It's been a problem forever.
If it's not an 8th edition problem, it was a 2nd edition problem. I mean, this has just always existed.
And this is the way it is in a lot of games. That's why chess clocks exist, right? It's a problem in chess. But the other cool thing too is that as we move more and more into 40K becoming a spectator event, which I think is so exciting and so cool and fun because it'll bring more people into the hobby. It'll get more people excited to play. Because visually, it's such a cool thing to see, right? Like, the aesthetics of it is what makes me like it more than chess. Mm-hmm. The element of the clock adds a whole nother degree of tension and drama to the game. When player A has got 15 minutes left on the clock, but player B has got 22 minutes left on the clock, now there's a whole nother meta strategy that's being added in that adds excitement.
Well, I mean, right? Let's think of football. You know, I mean, clock management is, in professional football, you know, the most widely watched thing in the world or whatever. I mean, there's a degree of tension and suspense that keeps people on the edge of their seats.
Exactly, right? You know, the Patriots have 5 seconds left. They can get 2 snaps in. Oh my gosh, what are they going to do? Right? Instead of like, oh, if they just don't do anything at all and the clock runs out and they automatically, you know what I mean? Like, that's not extreme. That's the opposite of exciting, right? And I think it's really important that we consider that as well, because with the advent of Twitch and Facebook streaming and all this fun stuff, you have the potential to reach tens of thousands of people that might love 40K, but they don't know it yet. And every time you put a game out there, you're an ambassador of the hobby, and people need to think about that too. And I think that that's really important. And then the chess clock, I think, enhances that experience.
It solves some problems, more problems than it creates, if you ask me. I think that is a solution that has like a big benefit to it if you're able to implement it in a fair way.
The flip side to that coin is that there's a lot of people that are going to be listening to us talk right now that are like, man, I don't go to a tournament to win or be sweat dripping off the end of my nose, ultra competitive. Like, they're like, I'm there to drink some beer and have fun and meet cool people. And that describes the majority of the people that come to a big tournament.
Yeah.
So we're trying to be mindful of those people as well and to provide them with the best experience that they can get. And they may not want a chess clock, right? Like, they may not care if their game goes the distance or not, and it doesn't impact the overall event at all. So we're trying to thread the needle and come up with a solution that lets people who are casual competitive play the game that they want to play, but then having the, you know, tip of the spear, so to speak, be kept honest and having the games finish. So it's going to be a learning experience as we go.
I get it. And then where is that cutoff? I mean, I guess you can actually see, though, like on a two-day tournament, you have a pretty good idea of how many tables could potentially catapult someone into your top award categories. And that's a much smaller amount than everyone there at the tournament.
Yep.
Now, that doesn't mean that every game doesn't matter and that the people and that the person on table 50 is not playing as hard as the guy on table one. You know, I'm just trying to find ways that people could kind of ease it into their structure without potentially having to go out and buy 100 chess clocks.
I agree with you 100%, right? Like, every game matters. Like, the person that's playing on table 50 on day two and they're 0-4, but they're just trying to get that one win, that is super important. And as a tournament organizer, you need to be thinking about those people too. However, the reality of the situation is that if something goes haywire on a table that people are paying attention to, that is all that anyone will talk about your event.
That is true.
The next 90 days, right? So it's like you have to work in reality and come up with solutions to the perceived problems.
Yeah.
But ultimately, yeah, you owe it. They paid their money. They took their time to come to your event. Every single person there deserves your attention and they deserve to have a good experience.
I know it's easy for us to say, like, just put it in your rules pack that if you suspect your opponent is slow playing, then tell your judge, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
That's putting a lot of onus on a guy who might just be trying to go along and get along and not realize that the slow play is happening until there's 10 minutes left in the round.
Yeah, and it doesn't happen. Like, Frankie and I talk about it all the time. We're like, why didn't you say something? Why didn't you call? I would have kicked this guy in the butt.
Yeah.
Told him to stop. I do it all the time. But you, like, someone there, like you said, somebody's coming to have a good time may not want to have some, like, confrontation at the table. That's not what they're there for. They're there to just have a good time. So that's another argument in favor of the chess clock, is that it's impartial.
Yeah, it is there. It's just a there, right?
Yeah, you cannot argue the clock. Like, it is relentless and ruthless. Oh, you took too long? Well, that's on you.
I do think, though, that an easy way to experiment with this is, like, it's not hard to get one of these things. You could take it to your local game store or your game night and just see how it goes. If you're running a tournament, you know, you need to get comfortable with how it works also. Like, you don't want your solution to be put in place the first round of your tournament. You want to know how, you know, predict how it's going to work leading up to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you need to play several games. And we've been working with some guys in the Midwest who've been using chess clocks for two editions now in their tournaments. And they have a system. It's one page of rules. It's pretty easy to grasp. And we're working with them. We're hoping to publish these, like, next week. It's kind of like a V1.
Rules of etiquette, you know, for the machine.
For how to use the chess clock. Like, what happens when you run out of time? What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, when do you pause the clock? How does that work? And we want to put these out there for people to use, to give feedback. You know, it's going to be quote-unquote open source. It's going to be, we're all going to learn to do it as we go, but you need to start somewhere. And these guys have already done the hard work of experimenting with it in live fire, you know, scenarios. So we want to put them out there and start getting, you know, thousands of games.
Yeah.
And we can really perfect the system.
That's the best thing about missions and theories or whatever, is that that people will play with it, you know.
And they give you great feedback. When you know, it's the wisdom of the crowd, right? If you get 10,000 people saying something is wrong, it's probably wrong, you know? And it's great that our community is so passionate about what we do that they want to give you the feedback. They want to be a part of shaping the experience that they get, which is great. And I'm sure in time that we'll perfect it. And if you don't think it's appropriate for your event, if you want a more friendly style event, by all means, do that.
See, that just means so many different things to different people, though. When you say friendly style event, and, like, I just want a fair event. I mean, I feel like everyone in their heart is genuinely trying to be friendly. It's when these weird situations come up that start to create that friction. And you know, now granted, we all know there are bad apples out there that seek to kind of thrive or take advantage of that friction. But, like, 99% of the people don't.
I agree with you 100%. And I apologize. When I say friendly, I mean, like, the OVO friendly event, not like that every other event is unfriendly.
Oh, and I got no, I get what you're saying. I just wanted to kind of put how it's like, that's a perception thing. Like, someone is not being unfriendly just because they want structure around some things or fair and an equitable amount of time, you know, or something. You know, that's not an unfriendly thing to want.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, it's like I like to do fun runs, like 5Ks and all that kind of stuff. Ooh. And
what's fun about that?
Well, you know, different shows for different folks. But even in a fun run, there's structure, right? Like, no one gives a shit if you – pardon my French. I apologize. Nobody cares if you win or lose or whatever. Like, the goal is to get across the finish line, and everybody celebrates that success together, whether it took you 3 hours or, you know, 20 minutes. But there's still rules. There's still structure. You know, like, it becomes meaningless if it's just a total free-for-all. So you just have to try and figure out, like, how much structure do we want in order to facilitate the fun.
Yeah, there is a balance, and it really is. I mean, we are playing. I don't want to have it come off like I'm a fluffy bunny either. Like, I go to tournaments to try to win and I do enjoy completely taking my opponent's head off, if that's the way it works out. Like, I take enjoyment in that. But I still want the same thing that guy across the table wants, which is try to have as good a time as we possibly can and operate within a fair environment, you know, knowing that we're there in the cooperative spirit.
Exactly. And when you play the game, when you think about the game, when you think about your list, when you're looking at all the different armies, the assumption is that you will finish a game. Yeah, you will play all the turns, and some armies are better in the early game, some are better in mid game, some are better in late game. And the only way to get a fair experience is to force players in that specific situation to finish their games. And that's where we have come. That's the conclusion that we have drawn, is that there is no other system that accomplishes these goals that is also fair and equitable and easy to manage.
I agree with that. And that's what kind of the conclusion that I have come to myself, is that this time equation is the one that needs to be solved for. And now, whatever that solution is, or the ultimate solution is, I don't know, but that's where we see a lot of this this friction and shenanigans build up, is around time. And it could also be just a perception issue. Like, if I perceive that my opponent is taking up too much time, it might not, we might have used the exact same number of seconds, but we don't have any way of knowing that.
Exactly.
Without this. And so it, when we're scoring it up and he's got me by one objective point, then I start to get a little salty because I feel like he used 5 more seconds or whatever than I had.
And then you walk away and you go, perhaps he slow played me, but there's no proof. Right. There's no objective measuring system to show whether that was or was not the case. The one thing I've learned about the chess clock is that it's a very enlightening experience, because you're like, oh, wow, I'm the slow player. Like,
wait a second. All these years, it's been me.
Yeah, you know what? Oh, you know what? The common denominator throughout all these equations, it's just so happened it was me, not my. I wasn't being slow played by 20 people. I was slow playing them. And what it's taught me using Chess Clock is that my opening game is slow as molasses. I play really, really slow. I very think out my deployment in my first turn, and then I go like, fire. My turns after that are 5-10 minutes.
Well, because then you only have like 2 figures left on the table.
Yeah, well, often that's the case for me.
Well, me too. I got one guy with a storm shield just hoping to get all the work done, so it's easier to move around.
Yeah, it teaches you about the way you play the game. Like, for me, I think out, I try to envision what's going to happen in the beginning, and I set myself up to achieve that goal. And after that, it's easy because I already know what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a very enlightening experience to play with the clock, because you're like, you're getting direct feedback about how you play as an individual.
Sure. And that's also a tool for getting better. I mean, when you train yourself to do things almost like reflex, then that's less decision points you're having to make in a game, which will make you a better player.
Exactly. And it forces you to make decisions quickly and decisively. Like, you can't sit there and run through every scenario in your head because you're looking at your clock and like, oh, I'm hurting myself. I need to speed up. Like, your first impulse is usually the best one anyway. So it's like, I find that it makes the game more engaging and fun because there's another element that you have to adjust to.
Right. No, I get you. And I think there will take some period of adjustment to whatever it is. But I think that as we start to really focus and get eyes on, I mean, like, how many thousands of people tuned into the games over the weekend of the LVO? And have watched them since. It's a lot. It's a lot of people, you know. And so this has brought a larger awareness to this type of stuff than has ever really existed before. And then we do have the benefit of kind of reviewing it and trying to look at it more objectively than maybe we have in the past.
Exactly. The data is only going to help us to improve because it's subjective. You know, there's no opinion involved. It's like hard numbers. They don't lie. You look at it and you're like, we had a shockingly low number of games go the distance. Okay. I can't add more hours to the day. There's a limit in which we have to work with how long we can make the rounds. So now what do we do? Well, we've put out the carrot, because with the ITC Champions missions, the carrot was you get more points the more rounds you finish. Well, the carrot's not working, so now we need the stick.
Yeah.
I'm confident it'll work. It'll make the game more fun to watch. We'll have decisive victories, not these asterisk next to the victory only went two turns. Okay, like, that, no one wants to see that.
No, you're very right. And the way I kind of come at problems is I try, especially when I'm like in other areas that I do stuff in, it's like, don't state the solution in the problem. You know, like, don't say there's just not enough time in the rounds or whatever, or everyone's playing with 2,000 points and that's the problem. You know, that limits how you go about solving it. You know, what be a little bit more objective what the actual problem is, and don't describe a solution when you're talking about the problem or when you're trying to describe the problem.
I absolutely agree with you. You'd be shocked at what is possible when you allow yourself to accept that it is indeed possible. You know, you remove the limitations and then, you know, it's an infinite landscape of what is doable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, a year down the road, everyone's like, of course you can do, you know, X, Y, Z. Like, the first time someone did a 900 in the half pipe, they thought it was impossible. And now 16-year-old kids do it. Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. 14-year-olds in the Olympics doing quad jumps on ice or whatever. I mean, like,
yeah, exactly.
That's impossible for me. I'm never going to do that.
But as soon as you accept the fact that it is possible, you know, any of the internal barriers you put up go away, and then it becomes normal, right? It's crazy how those things work.
Yeah, now it's just a question of how many quads do you do? You know, not if you're doing one. It's how many are you going to do? What a world.
I think speed chess is a thing, right? People play brilliant chess in seconds per turn. You know, it's crazy. So anything is possible. You just have to find the right structure in which to fit everything.
Yeah. And we're working within a different little bit of an environment also. Like, I know we want really competitive games, but there's a reason that I don't play like chess competitively. There's a reason I don't play Go. There's a reason I don't play as much Magic anymore. It's because I prefer the way that 40K is.
I agree with you. The aesthetics of it, the social aspect of it, the fun of it, it makes it my favorite game.
So do you foresee a time where there's not a place for that in competitive spectator 40K?
I don't think you're going to ever sell a ticket to an event to watch 40K when the game takes 4.5 hours. I just don't think that's going to happen. Maybe. You know, if you watch the Chess Masters, they take as long as they take. But there's a reason that it's not on ESPN8, right?
The Ocho.
It's just, you need to make it more exciting. Esports have blown up because it is visually stimulating. And if you have a good announcer, it's really cool to see it. With 40K, I think that if you go the route of the more casual game, you could make it aesthetically stunning in stills, right? You could take some pictures of the game and it could be, you know, beautiful and amazing. And you could string together something like a montage. But as something that's fun to watch, I really don't think that that's viable. It's just too slow. If you're looking at a camera shot of two guys, you know, cupping their chin, intently staring at the table for 30 minutes, that is as dull as I could imagine something being.
So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I hope that we get to a place to where we are able to play really tight, meaningful competitive games where I don't want to make it seem like that, like, player fatigue and stuff shouldn't come into this. Like, that is that's an element in almost every single competitive and quasi-competitive thing, period, in the world.
Yeah, I mean, look at competitive cup stacking, which I thought was absurd until I saw it, and it's amazing.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And they have to manage these things too, you know, and it's like, yeah, you're right. But then the onus of responsibility then falls onto the player there, which I think is totally fine. Because it's like, if your instincts are to push yourself and compete at the highest level, well, then you need to be able to manage your endurance and eat some protein bars.
Yeah,
you
drink,
know, like,
drink a lot of water. I mean, yeah, I get it. There's a difference in between. Like, there's some percentage of people out there that think that, like, getting one over, honestly, on your opponent is not sporting or whatever. But, like, if the opponent's the one that really made the mistake, then that's not a bad sporting thing. So that doesn't really take away from the social element of it. But, like, what? But it's all, when you start talking about it this way, it all kind of becomes gray and murky and, like, what's real and what's not, you know?
No, I agree with you. But that's all kind of the fun of working your way through all these, you know, nuances of what it means to have a competitive tabletop game.
Yeah.
And I love it. I think it's great. You know, where are the lines drawn? And it's fodder for really engaging conversations, and it gives people things to think about. And I think that's one of the best things about what we do.
Oh yeah. On the other side of this, we're going to have a more meaningful and a quantified structure to the circuit. I mean, this is just going to be beneficial, like having this exercise and talking about it and seeing some of the things play out the way that maybe in your mind you thought they would, but the likelihood was small, you know, then we see that happen and then we get to make something better on the other side of it.
Yeah, I agree. But to get to that point, right, to where we have like what is perceived as a fair competition, you need structure in place that forces people to play the game and finish it.
I mean, that's fair. I'll give you that. But that's what we should be doing. Like everyone, we should be doing that. And just now really identifying that's what we need to build some of the structure. There's leaky. There's some holes in that structure. We shore that up. We take time out of the equation of being something that can be manipulated.
Right.
And then I think we're going to get a much better term and experience.
We're going to get better games. It's going to be more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, think about the drama. Like, imagine a situation where, you know, you've been straining your brain to the max and you're playing a really, really tough game and you've come to the part where you've got 6 minutes left on your clock, right? And then you realize, I've got to somehow squeeze 2 turns out of 6 minutes. Think about the drama and the excitement that will come from that. Like, the brilliance, when someone stops, like, trying to think about it and lets their instincts take over, and they're just flying around the table doing things that surprises them as they're doing it. And then they squeak out some kind of a crazy victory out of that scenario when it was against all odds. That, to me, sounds amazing and fun and exciting, right? Like, that's going to draw more people in.
Right.
And make more people excited to play the game as opposed to just, like, plodding along and letting things settle down on turn 3.5 where the other person doesn't even get to finish the bottom of the turn. I mean, that's a tragedy.
That's depressing. I know the idea is that everyone gets the equal amount of turns, but sometimes, you know, a hard dice down is a hard dice down. And
yeah, it happens. And that's just patently unfair.
Yeah.
That's not a game when I play 3 quarters and you play 2.
We focused a lot on the time, but again, I agree, man. I think if you get something in place for that, a lot of these other things just kind of melt away and take care of themselves.
I agree. And I think one of the other big things that we've been trying to, that we have successfully pushed, is that your army needs to be painted and based. And that's that, right? Like, this is also
real depressing to play against a substandard army, a painted army, you know, like the 3-color minimum to the extreme, like one glove is painted, a gun barrel is painted, and one boot is painted on a guy. Get out of here.
Yeah, that's not fun. Like, I know you're a total hobbyist too, Paul. Like, I love to paint and hobby and read the books. And that's just as important as the time and all the other things we focused on. So it's like, we kick people in the pants this year and we're like, we will pull your models off the table if they're not painted and based. And we had to do it multiple times, which sucked.
Oh, man. The first guy you enact that policy on, it's got to feel like you've got to feel bad about it.
The first guy we had to do it to was one of the nicest people you've ever met. He's my friend. And I had to be the one to go like, yeah, those crisis suits have to come off the table. I'm really sorry. But you know what? He took it in stride and he's like, I didn't read the rules. That's on me. And he painted them that night, showed up the next day, ready to rock and roll. So the feedback, though, was universally positive. Everybody was like, I had so much more fun playing against all painted armies. And it's like, you really have to do that. Like, you need to push all aspects of what we do to make it the best possible experience at an organized play, match play event. Like, it can't just be competition. It also has to be, you know, a hobby. And, well, and I think if you do that, it's going to make everyone have so much more fun.
It may feel like these games take forever, but we spend, like, the percentage we spend actually playing the game for most of us is way smaller than we do the other aspects of the hobby. Daydreaming about some army list or some lore element or painting our own models or whatever. It's such a, you know, the pie chart on that game, the playing the game is a thinner slice.
Oh, for the average gamer who plays twice a month, they spend 95% of their time interacting with their hobby by themselves or online, right? Like on a forum or a Facebook.
Yeah, man, that's cool. And I know, again, we talked about a lot of the kind of the grisly bits of this stuff, but I just want to say this is my first year that I went out to the LVO and had an amazing time, by the way. You guys put on an awesome show. It felt every bit as much like a convention as things like Adepticon do and other stuff like that. And just really top-notch entertainment. And anybody who hasn't experienced it yet, don't let anything about what we've talked about dissuade you from wanting to come be part of this amazing experience.
Hey, thank you for saying that. And it was really a pleasure to finally see you there. And
just work had gotten in the way, man. No other reason. And I told them, you know, I made the rules this year. I said, I'm going out. Y'all deal without me for a week.
No, and I was just busting your balls, of course. Yeah. Like, I totally understand. You can't make every event. But thank you for saying that. And yeah, the 99% of the people that come, we had 2,000 people this year, which we were super excited about. You know, the vast majority of them were there just relaxed, maybe playing a little blackjack, having a drink, meeting new people, going on the pub crawl, just having a really fun time. And so much of the attention gets focused on so few of the people, but it's kind of just the way it is. Like you said, the average person coming to the event, it's just a relaxed and good time. And that's true of any of these big events, which I encourage.
A vendor hall that was more expensive than I thought it was going to be. I mean, it was in the other convention hall right next to the Termin area, but there was a lot of vendors there. I don't know the exact amount, but I felt like there was a lot.
There was a lot. You could do 3D Betrayal at Kalth. Did you try that out? Where you put on the VR goggles?
I didn't. I wanted to, but I just kept walking past. I'm like, I'll get it in a minute, and then I got distracted because there was so much to do.
It was amazing. You could be you had the opportunity to be an Alpha Legion Chaos Space Marine. It was awesome.
Man, and then there was all the other side events, and then there was open gaming, you know, and then there were the panels. And I mean, it was a really fun time, top quality. And I mean that to my core. This is not showboating because you're here talking with me. I had a great time, and I encourage anybody, if you can make it and you think that big tournaments are just about grinding out games, the bigger ones aren't. You know, I mean, there's a lot more to it than just that. I mean, you want to do that and you want to play that because you want to come and you want to play. In my first three games, I played people from three different countries.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's
crazy.
Truly international.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many international folks were there, but enough for me to run into them randomly, you know, everywhere.
Oh, no, it was amazing. We get people from all over the world now, which is so flattering and exciting and cool. And the thing is, like, if you don't want to play, you know, six games, possibly nine games over the weekend, the 40K friendly, we play four-hour rounds, two games a day, Saturday and Sunday. It's the most chill, laid-back experience. We have crazy terrain, like stuff you couldn't use in the champs because it's just too wonky. Like, we have one table where a building literally covered one third of the table.
Nice.
And you can have that experience too, or you could play in the narrative where there was 100 people playing in a linked narrative map campaign. There's room for everything, right? Like, every way to enjoy the hobby, you can do it there. You can just paint, you can just play open gaming. We try to appeal to everybody.
You did it. I mean, you nailed it. I mean, there were people there that were just coming to hang out with other painters and sit there and paint their miniatures around people that they had either talked to online or seen a picture of their work or just wanted to meet new folks that also were like an orc enthusiast or whatever.
Yeah, and that's what it's about, right? Because, like, the hobby is so much more than just who won the tournament. The hobby is about, like we said, it's about thinking about it. It's about talking to other people that share your enthusiasm. For a lot of hobbyists out there, they don't even get the chance to talk about their hobby, right? Like, they're like the lone ranger in their town that likes Age of Sigmar or 40K or whatever. And the opportunity to go and be around people that share your passion, that's worth the price of admission by itself.
That's one of the things. Yeah, we talk about that a lot. It's like, if you don't think you even have anything in common with the other guy, guy across the table or the person across the table know that they just traveled the same distance you did for the same goal, which is to play some 40K against people they don't know, you know?
I've made friends from every like strata of society through 40K, people who I would have never met in my life if it were not for, you know, tabletop miniatures games. And I'm so thankful for it. I think that's like the greatest gift I've walked away from this experience with, is meeting people that I would have never met and finding that you have way more in common than you don't. Even if you have like radically different political or religious views or whatever. And but it's like, you know what? We may not agree on all this other stuff, but I sure love rolling some dice, and like me too. And then you become lifelong friends. And I'm like, that's
let's think about this from a numbers game. Like you said, you had 2,000 people at the LVO. Only 490 of them or whatever were playing in the champs, right?
Yep.
So that means there's another 1,510 people that were there doing completely other things. Like over, like 75% of the people that were there were doing other things. And so if the 40K championships might not be your thing, there's 75% of the rest of the world there that might be into what you're into.
Yeah. And it's, but they're all linked by a common love for nerdy stuff. You know? Yeah. And that's what's so cool. They may enjoy
that way, hanging out at the bar. Awesome. I mean, you could strike up a competition or a conversation with anyone there.
You really could. And one of the crazy things is because now we're going into year six now. A lot of the staff know us now. We've actually gotten people that work at the casino to start playing 40K because they're like, what is this? This is so weird and cool. And you're like, yeah, check it out. And now we have people that like some of the bartenders there, they've been with us the whole time. Now they play the game, or their kid plays the game, and it's really cool to see it grow like that. You know, just funny, because people are exposed to it and they're like, "This is cool. I like this."
I know it sounds like I'm gushing a little bit, but I genuinely had a great time out there. Regret missing the last ones and so looking forward to the next one.
Every time I saw you, you had a fat grin on your face. I don't know if that's because you had a couple drinks.
That was the beer. No, great time.
No, it was great to see you there, and we've been friends forever. So I was really happy to see you come and check out our show, and I'm really glad to hear that you had a good time.
Amazing time. Well, dude, man, is there anything else you want to chat about? I mean, I know we kind of ran the, ran through a lot of different things about, but you know, it's some of the things that are on the mind of every tournament organizer and people that are even, you know, kind of casually thinking about coming to tournaments, you know, in light of all the things that have been talking and going on. They've seen on the internet, you know, heard on various shows or whatever. So it's really on our minds, and that's why we want to talk about it here as well.
The only thing I'd like to add is that thank you so much to everybody that comes out, takes time away from their family, their job, spends their money to come out and make these events happen, because a lot of the attention goes on the organizers for good reason. They work their butts off, but none of this would happen if it weren't for the people that came out and participated and put their money on the table. So thank you, like a heartfelt thank you to everybody that participates in the community, because you may not be as the spotlight may not shine on you, but you are equally as important in the whole scheme of things. And thank you for everyone that participates.
Man, that's awesome. Well, since you're also a sponsor of my show, I'll do some plugging for you right now. You also have a website where you sell stuff. Where can people find their latest and greatest gaming mats, terrain, which the terrain is great, by the way. Where you have a secondhand shop for miniatures that people may be able to get some stuff up on the cheap.
We do. So frontlinegaming.org is the hub site. That's where you can find out everything. LasVegasOpen.net is where you can learn more about the next Vegas Open. We do make terrain specifically for 40K. It's meant to be affordable, durable, easy to build and paint, and to be really, really good for playing the game. They come in themed sets, and we make mats that match those sets. And we're also coming out with some Age of Sigmar stuff as well. You can check that out at store.frontlinegaming.org. We have a full-service paint studio, flgpaintstudio.com. And, of course, the secondhand shop where you can buy and sell used miniatures for store credit or cash. Check that out, and that's at frontlinegaming.org as well.
Great, man. Well, have a good rest of your night.
You too, brother. Thanks for having me on, as always, man.
Thanks for coming.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey, everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul. I got Chris and Justin here.
Feeling grim, Aldous.
I actually made it.
Yeah, it's not too late for you just yet, big guy. I hope that was a good segment. We talked about, you know, the evolving state of the 40K, you know, tournament scene, and then, you know, kind of doubled down on the fact that the tournament organizers are empowered to do things differently to see what works. And he was of the same mind that I am, that like time is one of the biggest constraints. And if we can find a better way to manage that time in some way, then maybe some of these other things might not be, you know, a big of a deal. But, you know, it doesn't feel like it, but we just had about an hour long discussion on that. it's been curious to see what people think as more organizers and stuff start to kind of take matters in their own hands and see what they can come up, build that better mousetrap for the solution.
Yeah, that's the real tough part, right? Is the time. 40K has never been a game that you can just set up and do in a half an hour, you know. So if we can train players to better utilize their time at the table during rounds, everything will just start to get a little bit better.
Right. Yeah. I think attempting to put everyone on an equal playing field in regards to the time is noble, a noble cause to pursue if it's possible. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. In this segment, things are going to get a little venomous. And some of this is good natured, by the way, but
poison 4+.
Yeah, some of it is going to get a little. I apologize for the harshness, but some of this things I got really rubbed the wrong way at a tournament recently. I'm playing at a local tournament, and there's a painting rubric, and you guys know that I paint for points. I'm not going there to expect to win best painted. I'm going there to get whatever my points are available for my painting score. I don't mind saying that. I know that I don't possess like a lot of natural talent to make something beautiful. I paint well. I'm happy with how much better I've gotten at painting over time. But I know that there are people out there that are just innately better than me. And when they've got the time and they put that time into an army, it's going to look better than my army. Those are the folks that should be winning the best painting awards because they're the best that day.
Okay.
So keep that in mind as I go on a rant here or complain a bit. So on the painting scale, one of the fields were, is this army fully painted? There's no primer exposed, or, you know, I think that was the way they phrased it. And then it went on to say, give the player the benefit of the doubt for these points. And then that was just one of the categories. And there were, I think, three or four more other categories. One of them was for a display board. One of them's for some conversion work and details or whatever. I checked most of the boxes. I took my Blood Angel display board with the carved Blood Angel symbol in it. It was like a ruined church. Just had the freshly painted Fire Raptor up on there for display. It's this. Other than that, it's the exact same army that I took to the Las Vegas Open that is well documented. Pictures that I post all over Twitter and the
I saw it.
Stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's painted. let's just establish that it's painted. I won't go into the fact that my death company have painted helmets and that on those helmets are painted skull faces over their helmet. I won't go into that. I won't go into.
You just went into that.
Yeah. I won't go into the fact that my chaplain is, my count says Lamartis has been my chaplain I've used for a long time, is built out of three other Space Marine metal chaplains and a Sister of Battle priest that Mephiston has converted from Astarath and looks beautiful, scroll work, detailed, every muscle painted. The army, it just looks good. And I'm not going to say it looks
good. There's love there. There's love in that paint job.
It looks good. Been really proud of how the Fire Raptor came along, posted all that on Twitter. It's painted, right? It's not finished. I'll say it's not finished because I haven't finished all the gems, but they do have, they've got a base coat on them. At least what I would consider a base coat is, in this case, is what a lot of people consider painted, you know?
I think I know where you're going with this.
I did not get that check mark for the thing for give the player the benefit of the doubt of whether or not their army is painted.
So when you first read that, that's a yes or no question. So giving the benefit of the doubt is a little weird in place anyway.
So the guy running the tournament was not the one that did the paint judging. And the guy that runs the tournament, he's a guy that organizes lots of local events. He, nice guy, very, very community minded dude. Like there's no, you know, and the guy that did the judging for the paint is also the same way. Really great dude, community minded or whatever. I see this and the guy, the main organizer comes over and says, hey, man, I just want you to know, in case this comes up later, that you maxed out the points, but we're going to award the best paint category to this other guy. It's like, no problem. legitimately no problem. And they said, because he maxed out more categories here than you did. And you'll see, and he points to me here. He's like, here, you didn't max out this category. And he shows me on the sheet what my score was. And then I looked and I was like, no problem, whatever. And I just put the sheet down. And then while my opponent was doing a move, this is during a game. And while my opponent was making one of his moves, I just looked at the sheet to see, oh, what could I do better for next time? For this area here, because that's what I'll look for points. I maxed out the points, but still the competition is there. Very fine. By the way, the guy who we talked about was an AdMech player with a beautiful AdMech army display board, giving the award all day long. Now, this is not about me winning the award. It's about being scored unfairly.
Right. So you, in essence, lost points due to a subjective.
Yeah, I could have lost points, and it could have affected my placing in the event because I wasn't judged fairly. And really, I know that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but whether or not this army is painted is not subject for debate.
There we go. Now we're starting. Now we're picking up steam.
Think of it this way: if I wasn't a fanatic, all right. I'm going to go to a lot of tournaments. I'm a fanatic. I love to play. I love to roll dice. I love to meet new people and stuff. But I spent most of my day before that painting this stuff because I didn't want to show up with a non-painted thing or a substandard thing in my army. So I spent hours and hours and hours just to avoid even the slightest perception that I'm not committed enough to my hobby and I don't respect the people that I'm going to be playing against enough to show up with my best looking army. Like, that's really important to me. And then to have this kind of happen and then be brushed off. I asked the guy, I'm like, hey, man, what on earth did you think wasn't painted in the army? And he's like, oh, I can't remember, but there must have been something. Like, no, there wasn't. And no, that you're not going to get a pass for giving me that excuse of you. There must have been something. But I didn't make a stink because, again, it wasn't about the award. I don't want to say I don't care about the award. I want to say that that dude was more deserving than me to win what the best, for that day, hands down. When points are involved, and it's also a point of pride. It really is. It's pride that I know that I spent hours and hours and hours of the previous day getting my army ready, and then it's like I didn't spend any of that time. And if I wasn't so committed to doing these things and going to these things, that is something that could have set me off and could have made me not want to come back and play in that event again. And that's one of that's one of the reasons I'm so on. Like, if you publish a painting rubric, if you have something, like that published, make dang sure you follow it, because it's really irritating when you don't.
Well, and on top of that, though, the answer that you received was very dismissive, and that would be a problem with me as well. And we'll take it just from the less aggressive concept. When you reached out to the judge, hey, what did I not do to max points so I better know next time? What can I strive to do for the next showing to make sure I do max that point? And then the answer that you got wasn't a beneficial answer to help you do that. It was, I have no effing clue, and I have to go over there right now, and you're slowing me down from doing that. That's how I'm perceiving how that interaction went down, and that's not good. If you're going to judge somebody on paint, which is subjective all around, if you're going to judge somebody on paint for that, you need to do it fairly, and you need to have feedback for those players and those hobbyists, that you're doing a disservice to them and the community by not providing the feedback afterwards, especially when they reach out to you specifically.
And I know that this dude was not, had no malice. There's no, it's completely well intended in whatever he was doing, and just doesn't know how important it is to me. But, and on the other side of it is, you're never going to know what's really important to someone else, I guess, when you're having these kind of discussions. But I just think that was really just off-putting to me. And when you couple it with the fact that I gave up doing some other things to paint, to bring, a good looking army, and then to potentially lose out points affecting my standing or whatever, is And then for that not to be taken seriously when I brought it up, I did not like that. I'm not harboring a grudge or grinding an axe. This is more like a cautionary tale that I want to mention it. I want to mention it like this because like this is the kind of thing that could really irritate somebody and alienate them from participating in what you got going on.
Yeah. So pro tip to all tournament organizers out there that instigate a painting rubric. If you're going to use a painting rubric, every question on that painting rubric needs to be yes or no. There cannot be any shadow of a doubt that did it have squad markings, yes or no. There's no in between. Was there distinguishable markings between the different squads, yes or no? Did it have X, Y, or Z, yes or no? Now that's your painting rubric. That's done. Those are your points for your hobby score. Now, when it comes to determining who's the best painted, that's when you get to get subjective, and that's when you get to go into the whole other realm. Well, this army didn't wow me as much as this one, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But the painting rubric itself needs to be clear-cut, yes or no. There cannot be any points of contention within that. And that's just pure and simple. And by doing that, you're doing two things. You're helping the players. So, you know, like Paul taking his time the day prior or the weeks prior or the months prior to the event, they're investing their time into ensuring that they're not going to be docked any of these specific points. Now, that is a return on investment for those players because now they know that they got all those points. And secondly, you're encouraging hobby innately by doing that. You're not going to just slap a color on an e-pad and call that a squad marking in most cases. People are going to do a little bit more.
I might do that.
In most cases.
But that's why you didn't get that part of the rubric, Palmer.
But that's right. Still painted. That's still painted.
And it is. Painted. And it is.
But well, you know what we're talking about is, you know, I know you're getting into more of the grain, the specifics of like, of a objective rubric and of objective criteria and not subjective criteria. And I think that, you know, you can do it both ways. If people are looking for an out of the box solution for paint judging, the hobby track for the ITC will be available in BCP pretty soon.
Yeah, that's good news.
It's really nice that they're rolling that out. I mean, you know, again, it's one of those things, development time. It's a lot easier to write it on paper than it is to get it into an app or whatever. But I got it on reasonable assurance that that's moving forward. And I think that's at least something to kind of that folks might want to build around. Or if you don't feel like laboring on creating your own, it will be something that's there for all you to always take a look at. Yeah. And then as people are competing for the best army in the ITC and stuff like that.
I feel more passionate when we talk about this stuff. I actually don't use paintbrushes. I use my thumbs, and I dip them in the paint pots. And, you know, that's how I go about painting. But I take a lot of time to get my blends in, okay?
Yeah.
He has his nails really well filed and shaped to...
That's how I get my crisp lines. You know what I'm saying? Peel away the wet paint before it dries.
And this is not, again, I will make it clear, I'm not harboring a grudge against anyone involved in this story. I'm only mentioning it in the way that I do. Again, like a cautionary type tale of like, this is the kind of thing that like really sets people off. And me included. I mean, I was pretty bummed and pretty hot about this. You know, like on the way home, I'm like, I still can't believe it. Oh man, one of those days, I guess. I'll still be back there next time they put one on and rolling dice.
But if this happens again,
no, I'll
prepare for the full wrath of Paul Murphy.
Prepare for a post tournament rant on FTN. I will only do things like this within the context of making things better, and I think that's it. Is like this: if you're going to anything that you publish or you just need to kind of stick with it or have people. But it's also difficult. Like, again, the guy that wrote that wasn't the guy doing the judging. And so was he really having the intent conveyed to him of what he was supposed to do? Maybe he thought he was supposed to be super strict. I don't know. I don't want to put too many defenses in place for something that I don't agree with how it happened, but I can still understand how it might have happened. I just don't want it to happen again to me.
Fair enough. And you handled it well.
Paint judging being what it is, I mean, there have been times where I've been asked to do paint judging several times, several different events and several different sizes. And the hardest part of paint judging for me isn't when I'm on my own looking at armies, and especially when I have a rubric. It often has to do with when I am forced to cooperate with another judge. because you know how art can be subjective and how different qualifications and things go. There was a guy I'm very familiar with, and he was called in as a third opinion, and he had like two things he did to judge models, and it was he would like flip it upside down, and if there was a part that looked like it maybe wasn't painted, then he'd be like, nope, that's a zero, or you know, whatever it would be. And there are people who treat it flippantly, and for those of us who do the work, we deserve better from our judges.
Yeah, fair enough. And again, it's sometimes hard to quantify. So again, I don't want to make it sound, you know, like I don't understand the other side, you know, and you two as being a judge. But yeah, I think we owe it to recognize it again. And even in the spirit of what 40K is about, we kind of owe it to always kind of give the benefit of the doubt on some of the more basic stuff. Now, you know, if one of your questions is this model quadruple edge highlighted? You know, that's a yes, no answer. And don't, somebody with three highlights doesn't cut it, you know? But anyway, I think we've probably beaten that to death. And I thank you all for giving me the space to get some of this off my chest.
Well, there, Paul Murphy. I hope you feel better.
I want to talk a little bit about actual hobby stuff in this segment. I don't know if this will be a true finishing moves, but I want to talk a little bit about the paint app, the Citadel paint app that Games Workshop put out that is absolutely free to download. And it updates from time to time. And what I saw like 100 different questions of people asking, how do I paint that white armored Custodes? How do I do that? People kept asking how to do it. That was even in like the Duncan, you know, comment. He'd post a video about something completely, or they'd post a video about something completely different on Facebook. People asking about how to paint this. It's actually in the paint app. Like a tutorial. I mean, it shows you the paints you need. Of course, it doesn't show you how to hold the brush or do the steps or whatever, but it shows you all the paints that are used to get that color scheme. And I think that is absolutely awesome that this is getting as updated as frequently as it has been. But I want to go back to basing. You know, we talk a lot about basing all the time because it's such an important thing to do. It's one of the things that, you know, ties the model together. There's a lot of benefits to basing. It makes the model look better. Like there are people out there I know who don't base the miniatures, and I don't know why they think that's good.
I've been in some arguments with people who would just say, well, I don't like basing. Basing doesn't do anything for me. It's just like, well, you're wrong.
Yeah, I don't get it. Now, I mean, it could be people that still see it as like a board game. It's immersive. But for me, it really does help showcase the paint job on the miniature much better than just either an oversprayed or overbrushed area on the base or just a black base top as itself. And with the texture paints and just a little bit of time and dry brush, there's zero reason not to have good bases. And I experimented this weekend with the Astro Granite debris.
That's a good one.
Justin, that's the Debris.
Yes. I unleashed my inner knowledge of the reading.
And the reason I actually wanted to talk about it.
Did you hurt yourself?
A little bit of smoke out of the ears, but other than that, we're good.
Okay. I'm glad you survived that.
The reason I want to talk about it is because when it comes out of the pot, now remember, this is the texture paint you can use it for whatever you want, I guess, but specifically for basing, when it comes out of the pot, and this could just be the pot that I got, it doesn't look like it looks on the basing tutorial. It's a little bit almost like powdery and like packed. It's like it's snow almost. It's really hard to describe. It doesn't look like busted up concrete when it comes out of the pot. At least mine didn't. And I'm thinking, what did I get myself into? Because I really want, I'm using this for my Demon Princes that were taken to Adepticon, is that I've used some of the black lava from Vallejo on there, but I wanted to have, like, they're standing in some busted overgrown type stuff. And I got a little bit of inspiration from someone else's tutorial to where they were painting Necromunda bases and they had like some toxic ooze on there. Now using some moot green and some other colors and stuff. And I thought and it was over a gray thing. So like, I need some gray on my base so I can put some toxic drips. I thought it looked cool. So how do I get the gray? So I went into the paint app and I'm like, there must be a tutorial in there for some type of concrete type bases. And sure enough, There's the urban terrain. It says use the astrogranic debris, Agrax Earthshade, and then Tyrant Skull. And I was really skeptical when it was coming out of the pot because it doesn't look like what it looks like on the picture here. But when it dried, it does. So, you know, win, I guess. But it almost put me off. I actually have a deadline. I've got a timeline I have to meet. So I knew it was like, I can't turn back. I can't figure out another basing scheme. This is what I'm going to do. So I just pressed on. If I had not had that time crunch, maybe I would have changed my mind and not did it. But putting on there when it dried, it actually looks like it's supposed to look. And it did take, and I probably piled on a little bit more in certain areas just because I wasn't sure if it was going to give me the effect I wanted. But it took a long time to dry. I basically let it dry overnight, and your conditions are going to vary. But then I did. I put Agrax Earthshade over it. I did not dry brush it with Tyrant Skull. I dry brushed mine with Celestial Gray. I did dry brush the brown part that's on the base with the Ushtabdi Bone and Zandri Dust, and then a little bit of Ushtabdi Bone in areas.
That's my go-to for tans.
Yeah, it's a great color. Which one, Zandri Dust or?
No, just I usually start with Zandri, and then I'll do like an Agrax Earthshade wash, and then I'll dry brush up to Ushtabdi Bone, and then maybe do like spot highlights of Screaming Skull or something.
Yeah,
and it creates like the perfect tan.
Yeah, that sounds like a good combo for sure. And I just wanted to kind of pass along that sticking to it, the tutorial actually served me well, and it looks in the end like it was supposed to, but it didn't start out that way, and I'm happy I pushed on.
The snow does that as well.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, it doesn't go on the base, and it doesn't feel right at first, but it does settle, and it does kind of do its trick once you manipulate it with the brush a little bit and stuff like that. So
I wonder if the base compound is the. I wonder. Oh, there you go. Looking at the snow tutorial, I just clicked on the paint thing. It actually starts with astrogranite debris, also.
Kaboom!
And then you finish it up with a little Valhalla Blizzard. But I wonder if the Valhalla Blizzard has a similar like. I wonder if like their base material is the same.
It's a little thinner than the gray version, but It's the same thing where when you're applying it and then you're looking at like the finished models already and you're kind of like, I don't know, but it definitely somehow magically makes itself work. And the neat thing that I found between all these like different debris based things, like I don't know what the stuff's called, like, you know, the sculpting compounds that they're using or whatever, it's giving like a different kind of depth. And each one is just a little bit different, and it does way different things. And you have to understand how each one of them work on application and in finished to really get the most out of them. So it's one of those fun things. I know it's expensive, but, you know, kind of play with them a little bit and see what kind of different stuff you get out of it. I've even gone as far as, like, mixing a little bit.
The pots last longer than you might expect.
Oh, yeah. One pot can do a good amount of bases. I mean, you don't have to put it on like an inch thick. You know, I think that's where people kind of like, oh, it's so expensive. Like, dude, it's really got to be thin. It doesn't have to be that thick at all.
It will work itself out. It does seem like magic. I will say, though, too, that if you don't use it all in one sitting and you think it's going to be a while before you get back to using that pot again, I actually store mine in sealed Ziploc bags.
Pro tip.
Because I've in the early days, and the formula could have changed. Matter of fact, I know it has in a couple of these. But in the early days, I'd come back like to a Sterling mud or something, and it would be dried out where I couldn't use it. And I've taken to putting these in plastic bags when I store them, and I have not had that problem. I've been doing this for now probably about 2 years or so. No more issues.
I tell you, man, when I moved to the South from Texas. And dry Texas, not like, you know, humid East Texas, a whole world of difference in how I have to do stuff now. I've lost so many pots of paint and stuff since I've moved here because storage is a thing. We should do like a whole show on that.
Pursuing, but I definitely suggest if you feel like it's a problem in your area, then stick them in plastic bags. That's my hobby tip. When you're finished using your pot of texture paint, put it in a plastic bag. There's the finishing move.
Boom. Brought to you by Paul Murphy's Models R Us.
Patent pending.
I have enjoyed, you know, like this getting ready for Adepticon, this sprint, getting ready for Adepticon. It is. I'm breaking out, techniques And then I'm even, you know, it's like what we talk about. One of the essence of the finish and move segment is spending 10 extra minutes, 15 extra minutes on a model to really make it look, you know, like you spend another 2 hours on it or whatever. And while I'm sitting there painting, I think of the same things. I'm like, man, no, like I talk about this. I talk about not giving up at this stage. Let me spend 5 more minutes.
I'm so proud of you too. It's not even March yet and you're already Adepticon planning.
Yeah. Oh man. Can't wait.
That's me that waits until the day before. That's right.
It's going to be good time. No.
Day before is a little bit generous, Droop. I think you're looking
morning
for
of.
Yeah. Day of. Yeah.
There was some gems drawing on some Eldar dudes while we were being judged. Yeah. Yeah, that's possible.
So I got the Demon Princes finished. The Four Horsemen of the Nurgle Apocalypse.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it's going to be good times. Well, guys, I know we're
kind of... Not pictured horses.
Yeah. the four joggers of the Nurgle Apocalypse. That's when we need Demon Princes on horses. That's the real Rough Riders.
Now that'd be something. That would be actually a really cool project to make, like, Four Horsemen style Demon Princes.
You could do it with those, what was it, the Nagash models?
The Mortarks.
Yeah, the ones that came out, like SS Henchmen or whatever.
I would love to see some conversion ideas for that. If anybody's done that,
oh,
hit us
someone
up on the
suggested
Twitters.
Last week, someone suggested, like, you should use one of these. I'm like, you are exactly right. I should have used one of those. Yes, thank you so much for suggesting it. You are exactly right. I can't believe I didn't think of it.
It'll be my next year's model.
Well, guys, thanks for hanging in. Thanks for listening to the show. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, give us those 5-star ratings. And then if you are interested in a new style t-shirt, please check back. Up on the ForgeNarrative.net shopping cart, I just put up t-shirts for the Louisville Slugga that's coming up in June. That's going to be the tournament we are running. It's going to be at a game store, but it's a great environment partnering with the Bourbon Brothers out of Kentucky. And if I need to tell you anything, the Louisville Slugga, you guys know I like to have a good time. It's going to be a fun tournament.
Right on.
I like bourbon.
We'll see y'all guys next week.
Cheers, man.
Thanks for listening.